supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Good evening. I'm Dave Heller, WHYY News. Philadelphia officials today announced that the city will encourage the development of safe injection sites for opioid use. While the city won't run the sites, they will help outside groups find funding and build support. The city is calling the injection sites CUES, standing for Comprehensive User Engagement Sites. The idea? If drug users have medical supervision while injecting, the risk for overdose goes down. Plus, they'd have access to clean needles. A study commissioned by the mayor's task force found that CUES in Philadelphia could reduce the number of overdose deaths by up to 76. Law enforcement in Philadelphia is coming around to the idea. Police Commissioner Richard Ross acknowledges that with an estimated 1,200 overdose deaths in 2017, Philadelphia might need to look to an unconventional solution.
I went from being adamantly against it just to having an open mind. But I do know this. There's a lot of lives being lost. And that is something that in the world of public safety, that we certainly cannot just throw our hands up and say, well, that's not my problem.
City Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez represents the 7th District, where much of the opioid crisis is centered. She says that if the city is serious about the plan, they should take more ownership of it so that residents in her district won't bear the brunt of the crisis.
If we have a recognition that people under addiction are not in control of their lives, why are we letting them control the lives of thousands of people within that neighborhood?
Even if local support comes around, the deputy mayor, Brian Abernathy, says the city won't be able to prevent the federal government from cracking down on the sites.
I think we're confident that and hopeful that the federal government has more important things to do than to not save people's lives.
Because there is no funding or formal process in place for choosing an operator, the city says it anticipates that the process could take months. Camelot Caps is a school of last resort in Philadelphia. Kids as young as kindergarten age wind up at the Germantown neighborhood campus because they have extreme emotional or behavioral problems that require extra supervision. If you were being glib, you might say Camelot Caps is a school for bad kids. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports that these bad kids have a message for those who've counted them out.
Put a label on me unless he's talking records. You see me making major moves.
Sixth grader Khalif Henry and his classmates are used to being labeled. They've been written off, stereotyped, cast aside, and their response to those slights sounds like this.
They try to put me in a box now. They try to say I'm a bad kid. But I know that's not the case now. I'm just way above average.
Way Above Average is the co-creation of teacher Luke O'Brien and some of his star students at Camelot Caps. Kids usually land at the school because they've acted out. Some disrupt class, others fight. Misbehavior becomes part of their identity, says program manager Carolyn Abel.
I see them, you know, becoming more aware of it younger and younger. I'm bad. I'm stupid. I don't know how to do anything right. Nobody likes me.
O'Brien knows his kids feel different, but he wanted to flip that notion into something positive.
Everyone messes up, but we all deserve second chances, especially children.
O'Brien is the school's arts and music counselor. 2 years ago, he brought in recording equipment from home and started nudging kids to rap in class.
When we first started out, the song concepts and the things we were writing about were pretty basic.
O'Brien, though, wanted his kids to be able to do more than just keep rhythm.
And my goal is to really have them tell their story. I want them to get deeper with the music.
Often, the kids who go to Camelot Caps have been through personal trauma and turmoil. In his verse, sixth grader Jeremiah Johnson explains that he's still awesome despite the adversity he's faced.
I'm about to show you what awesome is. I'm about to show you what bossy is. You know I got the sauce, I'm the saucy kid. They got mad love for the foster kid.
Way above average means I'm not a bad kid, but I just need to work on some things. And the song is about who everybody in here, they have some problems, but like everybody in here, nobody's bad here. We all good.
I asked Jeremiah what makes him awesome.
I'm an awesome kid. Like, awesome kid. I can do funny things like, I'm Jekyll's the Clown.
After the giggles die down, Jeremiah and his classmates break into another rap song they've written together. It could be any group of friends at any school, but they sound a little crisper, a little more confident. Above average, you might say. Avi Wolfman Arendt, WHYY News.
The extent of citizens across New Jersey who've been victimized in recent years by out-of-control rogue cops is the focus of an extensive investigation by the Asbury Park Press. The paper's Andrew Ford is the lead investigator into police misconduct and joins me now with details. Andrew, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
What was your impetus to embark on this project?
I am a cops reporter, so I cover this beat. I have done it for just about 6 years now, covering all sorts of different breaking news events, crimes. You know, we came across a few different things on the cops beat that caught our attention. The one that sort of got me taking a closer look at this was a separation agreement whereby a officer who, you know, was found to have an issue with drugs was allowed to quietly resign, and we found that we were able to get a hold of this record that detailed his separation from the department, and we sort of gathered more thread on the topic, and at some point an editor, you know, felt that we might have enough to consider investing significant resources into taking a look at this issue.
This is an 18-month-long study that you've been at it 6 years. What were your major surprises?
Well, I guess sort of the scope of the thing. Some of our big findings include dozens of towns all across New Jersey, from some of the largest to some of the smallest, have collectively paid out some $42 million to settle allegations of police abuse that involves 19 cases, including deaths, and 131 involving injuries. I found 68 cops total who were allowed to quietly resign. Process. They took home some $700,000 in benefits. Now, that is money that they would have normally received if they retired honorably. A lot of these agreements included things like the township or department would agree to provide a neutral reference for these officers, and we found that at least three of them went on to continue their career in law enforcement elsewhere.
Your work also posits solutions to try to mitigate the problem. There are five of them. Are they mostly pertaining to more transparency?
Yeah, I would say so. That is part of our focus. A lot of these lawsuits include agreements that the parties involved won't talk about it. These lawsuits are signed off on kind of quietly. While they are public record, they're not always announced, and they do involve large sums of taxpayer money.
Put it in some perspective, there are some 33,000 police officers in the state. To what extent is this a big problem?
It is a tiny fraction of the whole, and I do want to take a minute to say that my colleagues and I have tremendous respect for the men and women in law enforcement who risk their lives every day to keep us safe. The officers that we've identified represent a fraction of the total. And the focus of this project is really on the system. More than I'm really concerned with any one case, I'm concerned with sort of systemic issues that allow this kind of thing to continue happening.
Were you able to contrast New Jersey with the practices in police in other states?
I can tell you that New Jersey is one of five states that does not have a process for decertifying police officers. And our public records laws are generally not as open as some other places. For example, Florida, things are much more transparent. I used to work in Florida, and it was much easier to get a hold of, let's say, for example, an officer's internal affairs file. You could find if there were, you know, sustained findings of misconduct by an officer.
Interesting that New Jersey is merely one of five states who haven't joined the majority. Who's championing the status quo?
We did reach out to some of the stakeholders involved and got moderate responses on some of this. I am reaching out to folks to see what they think now that our investigation has been published. It was encouraging to see that some of the people involved were interested in positive change. For example, we identified that 113 police departments in the state do not randomly drug test. They don't have a policy for for mandatory random drug testing. And the president of the state PBA was supportive of a sort of unified standard for drug testing.
Andrew, thanks for shedding light on this issue, and thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Asbury Park Press reporter Andrew Ford on NewsWorks tonight. It's been 2 years since Michael Nutter left City Hall after serving 8 years as Philadelphia's mayor. Nutter has written a book about his life and political career. It's called Mayor, The Best Job in Politics. He sat down this afternoon with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies.
Well, Mayor Nutter, welcome back to NewsWorks tonight. You spent 15 years on city council, did a lot of serious legislation, and then in 2006, you decided you're going to run for mayor in a field of heavyweights. Yeah. You quit your job. What made you think you could win?
Well, first and foremost, it's my family. Lisa had tremendous faith in me, Olivia as well, and you really need your family behind you. I quit my job, taking away at least half of the income from our family. It's the first time I was unemployed since I was 13 years old. We had taken a poll, which you know I mentioned in the book. My own poll told me that I couldn't win. So, you know. But Fred Yang, our pollster, I said, Fred, well, you know, what do you think? And he said, well, difficult but not impossible.
Right.
And that was it. I said, let's go.
As mayor, you deal with a lot. Budget crises and hurricanes.
It's a slightly complicated job.
It's the terrible Amtrak crash. I mean, a lot of things happen. And one of them was in 2011, there was a rash of flash mobs, kids wreaking mayhem in Center City. Yeah. And there's a moment I'm going to play here when you went and spoke at Mount Carmel Baptist Church. The sound's a little fuzzy, but we'll get a sense of it.
Parents who neglect their children, who don't know where they are, don't know what they're doing, don't know who they're hanging out with, you're going to find yourself spending some quality time with your kids in jail together. Together.
It was a tough love speech. You said, you know, boys are making babies and not taking care of them. This wasn't just a speech. You had some policy ideas you were presenting the next day, some truancy laws and some additional recreational programs.
Yeah, but carrot and stick.
Right. And what's interesting to me about it is the question, the extent to which the mayor can affect behavior by his own inspiration or example. You were telling people to change their behavior. Yeah. I wonder, were you impressed how effective you could be, or is it frustrating that people don't get it?
Well, it's a combination. I mean, that talk at my own church in a very friendly audience, you know, that was an old school conversation. You know, I talked about, you know, I didn't need a watch. I didn't need a sundial. You know, my mom said, when the street light comes on, have your butt on the steps. So I was trying to remind people of community. Yes, I am the mayor, but I'm a parent and a father, been through some stuff. I was a kid not too far from that neighborhood. And so I was really trying to deliver not only a very tough message, but a heartfelt message. I can't even express how angry I was before I got to the church when I heard about what happened and the people who were injured. And then it just all came back to me while I was there speaking to the congregation. And, I mean, I was here's a black man talking to basically black parents and kids about what's going on out here and that I was not going to tolerate it.
You're a relatively young man, for having served served 2 years in Maryland. What do you want to do with the rest of your career?
Well, I have what I refer to now is a portfolio of activities, whether it's teaching at Columbia, so that Columbia University in New York, graduate level, that keeps me engaged with young people in a certain way. I'm still focused on anti-violence activities with an organization called Cities United. I get an opportunity from time to time to contribute at CNN, and I do some writing. I mean, beyond the book is the book, but I do some other writing from time to time.
Could you run for office again?
I have no plans to run for office again. Part of the fundamentals of the book. I mean, I think I've had the best job. And none of the other political positions are of any interest to me. So, I appreciate the compliment that at 60 I'm still a young man. But, you know, I've been in this for 30 plus years. And I think there is it's time for a new generation, and I want to be a part of that and help new candidates, young people in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, step up and take the reins. You know, we're not really supposed to die in these jobs. And, you know, there comes a point, whether in politics or sports or whatever, like, move off the stage, get out of the way, let somebody else, you know, step up and do the work.
The name of the book is Mayor, The Best Job in Politics. Michael Nutter, thanks so much for coming again on Newsbreak Tonight.
Dave, thank you a lot.
1 year into President Donald Trump's term, it seems like political rhetoric has become more rancorous than ever. A recent Quinnipiac poll shows most Americans blame Trump and his tough talk, saying he's done more to divide the country rather than unite it. But as the gap grows between Democrats and Republicans, divisive discourse isn't a problem limited to the White House. It can even poison all our homes. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo talked to a newlywed couple from Elkins Park in Montgomery. They have such diametrically opposed views that household harmony is a daily crusade.
You know that saying, opposites attract? Well, you can't get more opposite than Gretchen Weishart and Tom Ellis from what they eat.
So I eat like quinoa and chia seed shakes, and Tom for breakfast likes to drink Coca-Cola and eat Fritos.
To how they keep house.
He's much tidier than I am.
To their upbringing.
Like Ozzie and Harriet versus Dharma and Greg.
But the difference that most affects their daily life? Their politics. She's a Democrat and he's a Republican. But we're not talking everyday average Democrats and Republicans. Ellis is such a staunch Republican that he has served as a Montgomery County Commissioner, a County Treasurer, a Cheltenham Township Commissioner, and a Pennsylvania delegate who backed Donald Trump. Weishart is such a devout Democrat that she campaigned for Hillary Clinton and even considered calling off her engagement to Ellis when Clinton lost.
Oh, all I could think was, oh, he's part of the problem. He supported this candidate who I believe allowed all of this blatant racism, sexism to rear its ugly head. I didn't think I could do it.
They're a political odd couple. And in these politically polarizing times, keeping the peace at home can be a daily struggle.
There's a lot of eye rolling, I think, on both of our parts.
Normally, she holds her temper better than I do. And finally, I say, no, you're wrong. No. But, you know, we discuss it out, and she keeps me grounded. I hopefully give her some new ideas.
And that's a familiar fight for more and more families. Discourse has become so divisive when it comes to American politics that just about everyone has experience with Facebook unfriending, Twitter tantrums, or fights over the dinner table with relatives who just can't quit insisting that their viewpoints trounce yours. In his blended family, Ellis is outnumbered.
My two daughters are as liberal as anything. When I was at the Republican convention and I was yelling out, Trump, Trump, I got a text from my older daughter, Dad, stop it, you're embarrassing us.
Ellis says he still supports Trump, even though he doesn't agree with many of his more inflammatory comments.
I'm not comfortable with a lot of things he says. You can't defend the indefensible.
But he and his family work hard to bridge their divides. For starters, they always support each other, even as they disagree. The couple went to the Republican National Convention in Cleveland together in 2016, and Ellis got his wife a ticket to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia the next week.
We're both really political junkies. Both of us, from a very young age, have been fascinated by politics and how it shapes our community. If we didn't understand that about each other, I think it'd be very difficult to be with people that aren't as interested.
That's ultimately what persuaded Weishart to marry Ellis, despite his support for Trump. Instead of shying away from political debates, they lean in. They spend Sunday mornings watching the news over scrambled eggs and coffee.
It's like the Super Bowl for us every Sunday. We get so excited to wake up and watch Face the Nation. You know, it's like those kind of things.
But they make sure to shut out the extremist noise.
We have a rule. We don't listen to MSNBC in the house. We don't listen to Fox.
And they always try to hear each other out.
When you come into a conversation, it's easy to say, well, I know what I believe and I'm firm in my convictions. And it's fine to be firm in your convictions, but it's not fine to not listen to somebody else and try to understand their point of view, even if you don't agree with it.
Remembering their common ground also helps, and they do have a lot in common. Both are lawyers, they each have two daughters from previous marriages, and they both studied politics at the University of Pennsylvania. Most of all, they're both passionately patriotic.
We might differ in politics, but we both love this country. There's no doubt about that. Otherwise, I don't think we could be together. The ends is where we want to get to. The means we might disagree upon.
And if that doesn't work, you could always try Ellis's surefire cure to ending a political standoff.
Send flowers. Usually that works.
Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
And finally this evening.
I don't think we expected it to blow up like this, honestly.
So that's Liz Parsons, head baker at Dottie's Donuts in West Philly, talking about the bakery's greased pole donut. It's a chocolatey tribute to crazed Eagles fans who climbed light poles, despite the fact that police had slathered those poles with Crisco ahead of the NFC Championship game. The shop sold out of the donuts yesterday, but expects to make more in coming days. Dottie's patron Andy Kissinger says the donut is the embodiment of Philly grit, just in pastry form.
We've been the underdog for, since Great Britain was trying to keep us down. I mean, we're always the underdog, and we always rise up, and we always win. We always climb that greased pole.
While they're currently sold out of the greased pole donut, Dottie is selling its creamed Boston donut in advance of the Super Bowl when the Eagles will take on the New England Patriots. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.